This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
I think that the most important thing is we realize that Food for Soul was not only a platform and a refectorio to be able to give a meal to someone in need, but also a teaching platform for people to understand how to cook better at home and waste less food.
This week on Sea Change Radio, we dig into the archives and listen to two very different stories about consumption. First, we speak to global journalist Nithin Koka, who's written a series of pieces for Manga Bay about Indonesia's alarming headfirst dive into the coal industry. We discuss the high-level corruption that allowed coal to take off in Indonesia, examine the lax regulatory standards that imperil workers while allowing the country to keep export prices low, and learn about the environmental degradation that the Indonesian coal boom is causing. Then we revisit our conversation with Lara Gilmore, who along with her husband, chef and restaurateur Massimo Bottura, Osteria Francescana in Modena, Italy. In addition to running a 3-star Michelin restaurant, Bottura and Gilmore have created a unique template for feeding the needy through their nonprofit Food for Soul, based on the concept of the Italian refettorio, a place where monks gathered together to share their meals. Food for Soul has elevated the soup kitchen to a whole new level, cooking and serving delicious meals in warm, elegant environments. I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by global journalist Nithin Koka. Nithin, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Oh, great. Great to be here.
So you have a few pieces in Manga Bay that are quite interesting that I wanted to discuss with you about Indonesia and its coal industry. I was kind of surprised that Indonesia has flung itself with such force into coal, which so many of us think of as just a dying fuel. Why don't you first kind of give us a thumbnail sketch of how this started? How did Indonesia kind of decide to go to what you call fossil fuels' final frontier?
Yeah, I'd be happy to. So I think Indonesia has always been, I guess, since independence and even before it got independence from the Dutch in the 1940s and 50s, like always a resource export country. And, you know, previous waves of exports were focused on like timber, spices, palm oil in the 90s. And then I guess around the turn of the century, Indonesia really started ramping up its production of coal. Basically went from being like almost a non-player in global exports to being last year the number one exporter of thermal coal. And it's been driven by the massive surge in demand in coal power generation in China, India, and Indonesia being geographically close to those countries being a key, having easy access compared to the United States or South Africa. And the fact that the lax environmental controls, lax environmental standards in many of the regions that produce coal meant that Indonesian coal could be a lot cheaper than other countries that wanted to export it. So it created a situation today where Indonesia, you know, it's one of the number one or number two export. And in a time where COVID-19 has created like an economic turmoil, the country is really trying to maintain its standing and maintain the kind of the presence of coal, even as kind of the headwinds are getting stronger and stronger around the world.
Where are things in the Indonesian government? It's no longer a dictatorship, but there's a lot of corruption, and it manifests itself in some pretty head-scratching decisions like this, doesn't it?
Yeah. So yeah, it's true. Indonesia is not a dictatorship. So the Suharto dictatorship, the Suharto regime fell in 1998, 1999, after more than three decades. But Indonesia never had this kind of big sweep and getting rid of all the people from the dictatorial era to today. So you have a lot of the same military generals and rulers and same oligarchs that have stayed in power despite this transition to democracy. And I think that's been one of the key factors. So a lot of the people that control the different ministries, a lot of the richest people in the country, they're people who made their wealth during the Suharto era. And coal is very, very closely connected. Several of, I think, the person who ran for president against current President Joko Widodo, his opponent, Prabowo Subianto, has significant holdings in coal. Another former presidential candidate is also coal wealth. Several key ministers in the current president's cabinet have a lot of holdings in coal, or a lot of interest in coal, as do many members of parliament. So there's a lot of oligarchical entrenchment in the Indonesian government, despite this transition. I don't think the transition to democracy really meant a transition away from oligarchy and a lot of the crony business dealings that Indonesia has seen since for several decades now.
And in an archipelago like Indonesia, it's so fragmented from island to island. We've had other journalists who've contributed to Manga Bay writing about some of the feel-good stories in terms of conservation in the country. And so that's one of the reasons I was surprised to read your expose on the Indonesian coal industry, because I think of Indonesia, I like to think of it on a positive trajectory, like it's starting to realize that it can't destroy its rainforest forever, and that there is some kind of an important environmental movement in the country as well. Does that environmental movement stand a chance against big coal in Indonesia?
Yeah, I think we often forget like how big Indonesia is. It's the fourth biggest country in the world. It's 280 million people, 10,000 islands. So just like in the United States, you can have states like West Virginia and Wyoming, you know, really pushing coal, and you can have states like California or, you know, Washington going 100% clean energy. So you can have those two things happening in Indonesia as well. I think the challenge, like, I think in several of the major big islands, such as Java, which is more than half the population, includes the capital Jakarta, you're seeing significant amounts of coal-fired power plant development. And I think in Sumatra and Kalimantan on Borneo, in the Indonesian side of Borneo, is where you're seeing a lot of the mining take place, and you're seeing a lot of environmental destruction there. But one thing that does give me hope that I did find when I was doing the reporting for these projects is that a lot of these smaller coal-fired power plant developments on outlying islands in Indonesia, on smaller plants, less than 100 megawatts, 10 megawatts, apparently are being canceled, and there seems to be some shift in those regions towards using geothermal or solar or tidal, even, in one project. So I'm really interested to see, like, I think there is some hope if the trends we're seeing on smaller islands with less people where renewables make a lot more financial sense, if that can kind of impact what's happening on the larger islands where you really have this entrenchment of coal mining and coal electricity generation. So these two things are happening at the same time. Unfortunately, the power in Indonesia definitely lies in, even though it's a geographically diverse country or geographically dispersed country, it's very centralized politically, and the power is still in the hands of a few. And those people, those few in Jakarta and in the upper, you know, business echelons are really promoting and pushing for government regulations to favor coal. And that's a big problem.
What percentage of Indonesia's coal is domestically consumed, and how much of it is exported? Do you know that offhand?
Yeah, I don't know the exact figures, but I believe it's 20% of Indonesian coal that's consumed domestically, and about 80% that's exported. And I think the key export markets are China, India, and then other Southeast Asian nations. Oh no, China, India, Japan, South Korea, and then Southeast Asian nations at a smaller percentage. And the government has plans to increase domestic consumption quite significantly in the coming decade. One of them is through what I mentioned.
I was surprised to see that Indonesia is actually building coal-fired plants fairly rapidly.
Yeah, I think at this current moment, Indonesia has more than 10,000 megawatts either currently at various stages of construction or planned. So it's one of the largest coal electricity pipelines anywhere in the world. And it's coming at the same time you're seeing neighboring countries like Vietnam, Bangladesh, and India really shift and kind of clamp down on their existing plans. Indonesia is still moving forward quite a bit. So it is an outlier in that sense, very much in the developing world.
And it was interesting to read that the Japanese banks have been kind of the traditional financiers of coal-fired plants in Southeast Asia, along with South Korean financial institutions, but they're starting to look a little bit more closely before throwing money at financing coal in countries like Indonesia. How do you think that may impact Indonesia's plans for expansion in this industry.
Yeah, so that's going to be really something worth watching. So last year, several financial institutions in Japan and South Korea both announced that they're no longer going to be funding coal-fired power plants going forward. One of the problems is that that doesn't impact existing plans. So any plants that already have financial commitments from Japan or South Korean banks are not affected. And that's unfortunately like most of the 10,000 megawatts I mentioned is already financed. So it doesn't have an immediate impact and doesn't have a short-term impact, but it's definitely going to have, I think, a longer-term impact. It's just uncertain what that impact will be. You know, I think people are still waiting to see how those commitments actually play out. And I think around the world, we've always seen, you know, commitments made by banks can often sound good, but they're not necessarily good when you actually look at like the impacts on the ground. And then China is kind of has been a holdout. So China finances more coal-fired power plants in Indonesia than Japan or South Korea. So if China continues doing that, then it might negate the impact of those other two countries' moves.
Come all you coal miners, wherever you may be, listen to the story that I relate to thee. My name is nothing extra, but the truth to you I tell. I am a coal miner, and I'm sure I wish you well. I was born in old Kentucky.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio, and I'm speaking to global journalist Nithin Koka. He has a piece in Manga Bay about coal in Indonesia. So, Nithin, the Indonesian population must not be thrilled about air quality. Just looking at purpleair.com, I see just in Sumatra, there's a lot of red and yellow and orange monitors showing very poor air quality. What does the Indonesian government plan on doing as it's choking its population under the coal-fired plant emissions?
Yeah, so that's something really, I think it's super interesting. Like the main grassroots opposition that I've seen to a lot of the coal-fired power plants, but also like growing in cities like Jakarta, which is becoming one of the most polluted cities in the world in terms of air quality regularly. In the top 10 most polluted cities in the world now. I think 1 or 2 years ago, like there was a citizens lawsuit filed in Jakarta that directly said the president is failing to protect the public health of Jakarta citizens. And I thought that that kind of like grassroots opposition, that could put a lot of pressure on the coal industry and then on the Indonesian government in a way that climate concerns, for example, may not, because public health and air pollution are kind of things that Indonesians will experience daily. So far, I don't think the government has responded yet. There are, I think, in the process of updating the coal emission standards, and it's going to be interesting to see if those emission standards are improved. Right now, they're very weak, far weaker than the United States or Europe or China or India. So they don't require these coal-fired power facilities to use very even kind of, you know, the simplest modern technologies. Not even considering like the expensive kind of high emissions reductions technologies. So I think the air pollution concerns, I think they're going to keep on growing. I think people are becoming more aware that of the connection between coal-fired power and air quality in urban areas and across Indonesia. And I think it's going to be more and more difficult for the government to ignore those concerns going forward. So it'll be interesting to see how they respond and if those actually do affect future coal plants.
Well, it's a terrific series that you continue to contribute to on mangabay.com. We'll link to it via Sea Change Radio. Nithin Koka, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. My pleasure.
I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by my friend Laura Gilmore. She is the co-founder and president of Food for Soul, and she's a partner in life and business with restaurateur Massimo Battura. Their flagship restaurant is Osteria Francescana, one of the finest restaurants in the world in Modena, Italy. Laura, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Hi, how are you, Alex?
It's so good to have you on. This is a real treat. I only wish we could eat some of your delicious food together. Laura is right now in your new restaurant with a lot of Ferrari artwork behind you. Explain a little bit about that.
Well, I'm in Maranello, which is a town that is about 20-minute drive from Modena. We're in the Emilia-Romagna area of Italy, which is northern and central Italy. And in Maranello, there is one thing and one thing only, and that is Ferrari. Enzo Ferrari moved his company from Modena to Maranello when he bought land here in 1943. And on this piece of land, which he then created all his factories and the whole beautiful Ferrari car business, there was a farmhouse. And he decided that that farmhouse was not going to be torn down, but it was going to become the Ferrari canteen for all the new workers who were coming to his business. And then in the 1950s, the canteen was such a success, it got turned into a restaurant for the public. And from the 1950s on, it's been a roaring place to celebrate Italian and Emilian food culture, Lambrusco on ice, and also car culture. So when Massimo and I talk about Modena, we often describe it as the place of slow food and fast cars. Slow food being Parmigiano Reggiano, a cheese that needs to be aged for at least 24 months for it to be officially sold as Parmigiano Reggiano, or prosciutto, or any of the salumi that have their aging process as well, all the way up to aceto balsamico, which really doesn't get put in a bottle until it's about 20 years old. So that's the slow food. And then on the other side, we're in the land of Ferrari, Maserati, Lamborghini, you know, incredible car companies that began at the turn of the century and have been innovative in Italy and engineering. Cavallino opened this summer, and it's a place to celebrate the slow food and the fast cars that defines this region.
So I want to learn more about Food for Soul, but first, tell our listeners a little bit about your story of coming to Italy and falling in love and becoming a restaurateur extraordinaire.
All right, well, I'm going to try to make a long story very short. When I did move to New York, I was a struggling artist and struggling to find any job at an art magazine. And I walked into a little cafe on the corner of Grand and Mercer called Cafe di Nonna. And it was run by a third generation Calabrian who was looking for someone to be behind the bar, who knew how to make a cappuccino, who could talk about wine, who could talk about Italy. And I had that vocabulary, and I had that language, and I knew about Italy, and I could speak it. And in walked my husband pretty much the day I started working, and he was taking a sabbatical year from his restaurant in Modena that he had opened 9 years earlier, back in 1986. And we met, and we spoke, and he told me that my cappuccinos were terrible every day, but he helped me make them better. And we joked around in Italian, and somehow that place became a place to make new friends and create a whole new community around Italian culture and life. And somehow in between that, we fell in love. And he convinced me to move to Modena when he had to move back to Modena himself. And so I've been in Modena ever since.
And one of the reasons I wanted to talk to you, not only because I can almost taste the delicious food that you and your husband present to people from all over the world, is that you have a different perspective about food than a lot of fine restaurants would. I mean, it's pretty all-consuming to try to get one Michelin star, as you mentioned, and now you're three Michelin stars and routinely ranked the number one or two best restaurant in the world. But you were able to find the time to carve out this nonprofit, Food for Soul. When we think of the sumptuousness of Austria Francescana, the other end of the spectrum is food scarcity, and you and your husband did not turn a blind eye to that reality. Why don't you explain the mission of your organization?
I will, Alex. I just want to take one step back and mention that, like anything, we can always find time for anything in our lives. We fit in time. But more important, I think, was for us that we discovered this calling and this mission through our process. So the 17 years that it took from when we opened our restaurant in 1995 to when we were able to be awarded those three Michelin stars in 2012, our whole obsession during those 17 years was about quality, was about small producers, was about communicating, you know, the beauty of Italy and its stories through food. But we were completely focused on getting our Michelin stars. And once we got those stars, something so interesting happened. We realized that those stars really only had value because they had given us a voice and that people were listening to us. And whether we were talking about a heroic farmer or butcher or cheese producer, we were making a difference. And 6 months into our three Michelin stars, there was an earthquake here in Emilia-Romagna, May 2012. And in May 2012, I'm not going to say it damaged our business as a restaurant. It damaged the town economically, tourism, Emilia-Romagna. But more than anything, within days of the first earthquake, we found out that 450,000 wheels of Parmigiano Reggiano had been destroyed. They had literally fallen off the shelves because of this earthquake. And at that moment, Massimo and I looked at each other and we said, this is an opportunity for us to use our voice, to use these three Michelin stars, to use our culinary skills, to use the quality of our ideas, to create something that will create more awareness about this problem and to help these cheesemakers survive, to communicate that anywhere from around the world, if you buy Parmesan cheese in this moment, you are supporting an industry that is in great difficulty. And so we did this through creating a recipe which Massimo took a classic spaghetti cacio e pepe, and he transformed it into a risotto cacio e pepe. And instead of using pecorino cheese, he used Parmigiano, and he shared this recipe virtually with Slow Food and basically communicated this message. And the reaction was incredible, and no dairy farmer closed, and no cheesemaker had to, you know, shut its doors. And we realized that a recipe can be a social gesture and can be an act of solidarity. And from that moment on, we started looking at the world from a different point of view and started realizing that we could have a great impact of things that happened outside our restaurant, not only inside our restaurant. And so when Expo came along in 2015, and the theme was Feed the Planet, Energy for Life, and lots of people were asking Massimo for a pop-up restaurant or to do some special dinner or this or that, and no one was asking him what he thought or what his ideas were about this theme, he realized that he needed to do something and act on his own accord. And that's when we started this project, and this little seed of an idea was planted.
Femmina, tu sei una malla femmina, che sto che fatte chiangere, lacrime infame da. Femmina, se tu peggio una vepra, mentre si cade l'anima, non posso più cambiare. Femmina, si dolce come zucchero.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio, and I'm speaking to Laura Gilmore. She is a partner in life and business with Massimo Battura, their restaurants Austria Francescana, among others, and she's the co-founder and president of Food for Soul. So what exactly is the idea behind the refettorio concept? Why don't you break that down for our listeners?
Sure. So instead of doing an intervention in 2015 in a, you know, expo fair, Massimo wanted to leave a signature, a mark behind that had a little bit more lasting presence. And so he wanted to open up a soup kitchen, a community kitchen, with the inevitable waste that was going to be produced because of a fair like Expo, and the waste that we have in all of our cities coming out of supermarket surplus, And he wanted to do this with the chefs that were passing through from Expo, chefs from all over the world. And the place that he would do this was in a refettorio. A refettorio is where monks would gather at the end of the day to have their meal together, and they would commune, and they would commune over breaking bread. Refettorio is an idea of a place where you are safe, where you can share what you've learned over the day or the difficulties you've had, and you share it at the table with other people. And that meal is not just nourishing because you need your calories and your energy to be brought back, but it's nourishing because you break bread together. And so we base this soup kitchen on an idea that a soup kitchen should be a place where people can come that's safe and beautiful and inspiring and have a meal together and be served a meal. They don't have to stand in line. They don't have to be at a self-service. And that those meals could be created during Expo by visiting chefs who are cooking surplus food that would come in from Expo or from supermarkets, surplus. Every day we wouldn't know what kind of food we'd have in or who the chef would be, but the idea was to create a three-course meal for people in need. And we immediately started working with an Italian association called Caritas Ambrosiano, the Caritas based in Milan. We found an incredible space that was a theater from the 1920s in a 15th, adjacent to a 15th century church in a neighborhood just outside the periphery of Milan that was kind of surrounded by train tracks, and it seemed to represent, you know, lives passing and going. And it was a neighborhood that was a little bit neglected, a lot of immigrants, a lot of poverty. And in the beginning, this neighborhood did not want absolutely a soup kitchen there. But by the end of 6 months, when we had been running this program, it was the volunteers and it was the neighborhood and the community around this project that actually convinced us that this small refettorio had legs and could become a model for future projects to come. And that's when we founded Food for Soul.
It seems like such a great idea, Laura, that shouldn't just be limited to your organization's limited bandwidth. Have you been able to convince any, or have you seen any uptake of a similar model in other parts of Italy or around the world where the refettorio model is being played out for the needy?
Well, I think we've had a big influence in the dialogue that goes around how we feed people. We don't feed thousands and thousands of people a day. We feed about 100 people a day, and we try to feed them with a certain kind of attention to detail and to communication and hospitality and building trust. And I think that that's really important.
Laura Gilmore, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Thank you, Alex. I love being on Sea Change Radio.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise. Additional music by Uncle Tupelo and Jerry Vale. Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.